Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show, Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 202. My name is Cameron English, joined as always by Dr. Kevin Folta. Kevin, what is going on? You have a very strange background. What's up with that?
It's a strange background because of some weird conflict between my computer and reality. That's actually Folta Lago out here. This is where I live, and you might see some critters walking around back there. Like, oh no, wow! When I move out of the way, you can see it better. Yeah, but there's like, you know, probably some pigs and chickens and things out there. But I have a house full of people from Ukraine, and it's noisy and smoky and smells like booze. And so I'm hiding outside. It's actually really nice. It's good that we can be a refuge for displaced folks who are having some hard times being at home. And so it's cold and awful there, and it's reasonable here. And so enjoying having some company. So, and my wife speaks Ukrainian. She's from there. So we're able to host folks with no problem. Pretty cool.
That's awesome, man. And it's good for you to do that, you know, because there's bombs dropping on your house. Not a whole lot you can do to stop that except to get out. So it's awesome that you guys are offering at least a little bit of shelter for, you know, people that are in trouble.
Yeah. And what's really cool is everybody's really excited to help with work. Like, they're excited to do things like power wash things and paint the house and all this. So for me, it's a lot more work because I have to get the ball rolling and I have to get everything here. But it's nice to have people really doing the job. So it's really nice. And then with Jontra on the way, some of them will be around after the baby's born, which will help out there. So it, you know, it's a win-win-win. So it was a lot quieter out here than it was inside. And I thought maybe, and my office where I would normally do this from has a mattress on the floor and a bunch of people on it. So I have to go outside.
Right. I gotcha.
Good stuff.
And by the way, when is baby Jontra supposed to be here?
May 23.
Yeah, man. Coming on up.
Yeah. We're 23 weeks in. So another week, and then it's a high likelihood of a viable birth. But no sign of that.
That's what every parent wants. That's what every parent wants, right?
Well, most.
I am hoping for a statistically significant chance of a high viable.
Yeah, I would say there's a few out there that are kind of, you know, in some states are probably hoping for something else, but that's a modern political problem. No, we're definitely on fire about this. She's dancing around a lot. I have weird dreams about the baby every night. Last night I had a dream that she was just a head. and I was feeding her by a spoon, and it was coming out the bottom of her neck, and so I had to attach her back to her body. And it's just screwed up, man. This has been a great experience, but it definitely hits you in the soul. So,
yeah, dude. When she's born, the first time you look at her, she's gonna look at you and go, "Oh, what's up? I know who you are." I promise that happens. That happened to me. I almost died. I was like, you know, it's just like, oh yeah, I've talked to you, so. It's cool, man. All right, enough of this talking about our personal lives. Let's get into these stories. So we've got three as always. First up, can large-scale agriculture overcome the stigma that it is not sustainable? Here's a 10-point plan to make that happen. Next up, MIT turns a blind eye to misinformation on biotechnology and vaccines promoted by infamous crank Stephanie Seneff. There shouldn't be quotes in that headline because she's just a crank. And then finally, and I really enjoyed this one, Kevin. Dietary boogeyman is oxalate, the root of dozens of food-related diseases, as alternative medicine advocates claim. Oh, boy. That's going to be a fun one. All right. But first up, Kevin, large-scale agriculture. Is it bad for the planet? Are we destroying everything by growing all this soy and corn?
Well, we got 2 weeks in a row of an article by David Zarek. So Dr. Zarek has a lot of opinions on sustainable agriculture. And he, you know, some of this I agree with, some of it I don't. And that's why I really wanted to take on this particular article in Genetic Literacy Project this week. And, you know, he proposes a 10-step regulatory guide, ideas that are sometimes pretty good, other ideas maybe not so hot. But I wanted to touch on some of them that I really like and some of them that maybe could use a little bit of improvement. And when he talks about a 10-step regulatory guide, he mostly is talking about how we get around the idea of just rolling with precaution. This idea that being conservative in our approach to taking on exciting approaches or technology-based approaches to solve problems, that it's not necessarily your best road out. And he has a lot of discussion of that in his ideas. And I don't want to go through the 10-step process. You can, or 10-step recommendations, you can see that online. And maybe you want to chime in with some of your favorites or not favorites. But the basic idea is that really refining what we call risk. And this is about that idea of abandoning this hard precautionary approach, because we miss so many opportunities, especially with changes in drought and changes in climate, changes in pests and pathogens. We change how farming is changing constantly. The backdrop on which we do it is changing, and putting in this precautionary approach rather than a legitimate risk-based approach means we miss opportunities to solve problems, and that there's this very dogmatic agroecology cult out there that says you have to do it a certain way or else. But we need to shed all of that, and also shed the strictly, it's a biotech solution too. There's people out there who promote that too, but what it is what works best, and getting into a real risk-based approach, solving the problems for farmers. The other one I really like, well, there's a couple I like, I don't like. I'll talk about another one I like that maybe would be a good one, and then, you know, hear your thoughts. Promote research in cover cropping. So cover cropping being the crops that are grown off season, and these are crops that can add they can do a lot of things. Add nitrogen, so nitrogen fixers that can help fortify the ground with nitrogen. Add carbon by adding biomass to fix carbon in the atmosphere, transfer it into the roots. You now have carbon in the soil that is sequestered from the atmosphere that also can have benefits in enhancing microbial communities in the soil, which can be helpful. But the big thing in cover cropping is also allelopathic effects. And allelopathic effects are when you have a crop that, and Zarek doesn't touch on this much, but it's really important, that maybe can repel other weeds or repress weeds, not allow them to grow to produce seed, which then challenges the grower. You're able to grow a crop that you can displace the weeds and manage its descendants. Pretty cool. And the other part of this is that there's some crops which even show allelopathic effects against things like nematodes. So the microbial soil worms that greatly decrease plant productivity. You have certain plants that seem to have effects of pushing them away from the soil and then leaving the soil cleaner for you to be able to grow what you grow. So that's it's a pretty exciting pretty exciting area where we really need more investment in. Farmers are adopting it. They get excited about it. We do it. It's expensive, but we think it gives us better results in the long run. So those are my two starting points, and I'd love to hear what you thought about this one too.
Yeah, I'm wondering maybe if you can just sort of fill out a few of the things he talks about, because they sound good, but I don't actually know what they mean. And if someone doesn't read the article, they won't either. So there's a handful that makes sense. So adopt a risk-based approach to agricultural issues. We've talked about that a billion times on this show, right? When you talk about pesticides or fertilizers or, you know, a particular breeding method or something, you need to balance the risks versus the benefits and try to come to a reasonable conclusion instead of just going, well, you know, you could have some wild GMO turnip escape and take over the planet, and pretty soon it's a new Jurassic Park movie, right? You need to look realistically. So that, I think that makes sense. You talked about cover cropping. make no-till farming the norm. I wonder exactly what that means. Like how do you make that happen? Do you push people to adopt these practices? Do you pay them to do it? How do you do that exactly?
Yeah, well, that's a tricky one because no-till farming does make a lot of sense because you lose topsoil, you lose it to wind and rain, and you also release a lot of carbon upon tilling. Sometimes, though, tilling is your best method for physical weed control, especially in organic practices where you can't use herbicides and where there are no selective herbicides. So you get broad spectrum herbicide effects. So trying to make it the norm, that's kind of a long stretch, but trying to have greater adoption of no-till farming is certainly real, or at least conservation tilling, maybe less tilling. The other issues he brings up, you know, some of them I agree with, some of them I don't. I mean, I don't know what, you know, encourage a more holistic agritech research environment. That's a tricky one for me to really take apart, even with his description that he has. But the idea of redirecting farm subsidies from volume to soil quality, I kind of disagree with that one. Farm subsidies are made to create a balance. And if you want to have less expensive meat products, you have to produce reasonable amounts of grain. And the only way to do that is to sometimes subsidize their production. And so there's a lot there. The ones that I really like in his list are ideas like trusting farmers as stewards of the land and understanding that farmers are not out there to poison us, that these are men and women who have dedicated themselves to producing products that are reasonable. And you know, there was a T-shirt not long ago that said farmers are the folks who work 400 hours a month to poison everybody, you know, that kind of thing. And to make no money and poison everybody, right?
You sons of bitches, I knew it. Yeah. I knew you were up to no good.
I also don't know about disincentivize or tax less productive farming practices.
Yeah, I wasn't crazy about that. Anytime you say we're going to punish somebody to change their behavior, it always kind of makes me nervous.
Yeah, or you know, to disincentivize things like organic farming, that doesn't bother me so much. I mean, organic farmers are working with one hand behind their back in that they can't use synthetic solutions to solve agricultural problems. So I say more power to them. We do a lot of organic research that leads to solutions that can be used in conventional farming. So try everything, you know, whatever it takes. Wow, my background's getting sunny as the sun goes down there. That's interesting. Anyway, so I just would recommend, you know, this is a 10-step regulatory plan, but something where each step really needs to be taken with a grain of salt. And, you know, hats off to folks like Zarek to think about it.
Yeah, that's good. And I've noticed this too, that I don't always agree with his analysis, but I like the way he thinks about it. You know, because the big point he's trying to make is that we need to rethink how we approach agriculture generally as a society. And we need to think more, I guess, more favorably about it. And there's certain ways we can make it better. And I like that he's taking that angle, because a lot of people, they come at it and they go, my conclusion is GMOs are bad, or, you know, Monsanto is poisoning the planet. Or, you know, if you're the glyphosate girl, you're like, hey, I got rid of glyphosate and I grew angel's wings or whatever. Like, that's how people approach it. And I think that he's taking a different tact, and that's really helpful. But let's leave that there. I think this Kevin's probably our most controversial story and probably the one we should spend the most time on. And this is, I'll let you introduce it, but we're talking about the difference between how some universities treat academics. So just go ahead. I know you're passionate about this.
Well, and it is, because it's something that's affected me professionally very strongly. And this article is by Hank Campbell on Science 2.0 that says, MIT turns a blind eye to misinformation on agricultural biotechnology and vaccines promoted by infamous crank computer scientist Stephanie Sennett. And I'm going to be really kind here and not make this personal about her very much. I've spoken at so many events where she's been speaking, because they invite me, they invite her.
Oh, really?
And I spoke in Hawaii. I spoke at one in Pennsylvania for the Ag Committee in Pennsylvania, where I went up and said, here's the technology, here's its strengths and its weaknesses. Here's what the peer-reviewed literature says. And she went up there and said, if you give kids with autism organic food, you cure the autism. And there was a big group of people there in the audience who were cheering around like, woohoo, you know. And the folks in the Ag Committee said, we really need you to settle down. This isn't a contest. This isn't a cheerleading thing. We have scientists who are here helping us make a better decision as policymakers. And she was just like the usual, just making things up about the you know, glyphosate causes autism, vaccines cause autism, all the stuff that she's saying. And afterwards, it was kind of funny. I was talking to her out on the stairs because I talked to the folks who are out there, and a woman runs up the stairs. And she goes, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I'm so excited to finally meet you in person. And I'm thinking, someone who really appreciates the science. And she runs up and hugs Stephanie Seneff. And I thought, oh, wow, we have got a problem here. Seneff has been – so who is she? She's a PhD-level expert in artificial intelligence who works at MIT. And she's not a faculty member. She's a staff member. Her husband is a faculty member and a physician, I believe, or at least a faculty member at MIT in an area involved in medicine. And she has a place in Kauai. And that's when I was out speaking in Kauai where she gave her talk. And she'll go into a room and really wave the MIT flag. MIT being a really, you know, a well-respected public university. And she'll start out a conversation by saying, she'll get in front of policymakers and say, in my laboratory at MIT, we have identified conclusive proof that autism is caused by glyphosate. And you hear a gasp in the room. And they imagine her with test tubes and autistic kids and pulling extracts and doing the hard research. She doesn't do that. She goes on Google and identifies tenuous links that maybe you can say, well, if I take a line from this article, and wait a minute, it kind of matches what they say over here. And it turns into like the stick pins and red yarn corkboard associations. And you'll see her use all the weenie words, right? She'll say, well, it's associated with, it's linked to. And won't actually represent real science. Yet, people will cite her work and will cite her stuff as research, mm-hmm. as primary laboratory research, because that's how she sells it. Yet these are really weird review articles in low quality journals that are never supported by time, never supported by further research, yet fuel social media arguments against glyphosate, against vaccines. And she's somebody, and I'll turn this to you in a second. I could go on all day.
No, it's okay.
She's somebody that she was on Fox News not long ago and with Laura Ingraham. And she made Laura Ingraham go, which I don't know anyone's ever done. I mean, Laura Ingraham was like,
disaster, let me tell you.
Laura Ingraham was like, we got to move along. Yeah, we're moving along. And she's like, and then they cause autism and one half of kids will be autistic. And the vaccines are no doubtably causing changes in neurological and bovine spongiform encephalopathy, mad cow. She's going on. So it was, and then the folks like at Center for Food, Michael Hansen's group, Food Integrity. They were all in emails that were captured by somebody. I don't know who. They even said, even the anti-GMO people don't like Stephanie Seneff. They go, she's a little bit out there. Yeah. So I'm not going to be personally really mean about it, but she's out in left field. So here's the issue. MIT lets it happen. And so when Hank Campbell says they turn a blind eye, it really is amazing that an astute organization like MIT would not rein this in. because their name goes along with some really bad ideas. There's a turkey walking by. And on the other hand, we bring up Susie Wiles. And those of you who don't know Susie, she is a very, well, I don't know the best word, gregarious scientist.
There you go.
Excellent scientist. And she, you know, she has flaming pink hair, combat boots. She's totally cool. And she has been the voice of New Zealand research against COVID-19. Meaning, or for COVID-19, meaning she's been the authority in the area of COVID-19 and vaccination. And her university got so many complaints and so much heat that they told her, take a leave of absence. Not just to be quiet, but we kind of need you to shut up and go do something else. I was told in November 2019, end the podcasting, end the communication, not your job, shut up. We're giving you a big teaching assignment. You can't travel anymore. Cancel every talk you got on the books. And it's devastating. So here I am working for a public university, Susie Wiles, working for a public university. Yet we are shut down. Yet someone who's spreading blatant misinformation is allowed to continue to do it. And so that's why I get a little passionate about this. That's why I get a little upset about it is my university eventually told me, all right, we're lifting all the restrictions. Of course, this is after, I've been canceled from everything. And the bad guys have already noted that universities have shut it down. And, it's horses out of the stable. And my appointment was changed to teaching. So I can't go anywhere and travel and speak anymore anyway. And I do podcasting as outside work. So this has no university affiliation because it's demanded that it couldn't be that way. So you see this dichotomy. The folks who are out there fighting for science are told shut up. The folks who are out there spreading the misinformation are told keep it up implicitly. So I've raved on for 5 minutes. I got to shut up.
It's okay, man. Because I'm passionate about this too, but I read Senef's work because I've reviewed it and I've written some stuff about it, but it's kooky, man. Like for one thing, the journals she publishes in are not really journals. They're WordPress websites that have been set up. They're not indexed by PubMed or any of the like major distributors of academic work. They don't have an impact factor, which means that the stuff that's published there, it's not cited by other scientists. And that's what makes a peer-reviewed journal credible ultimately, is if the work is read by other academics and if it's cited by other researchers. And that goes to the point you were making about building upon previous research that's been done. That's what gives you credibility in an academic discipline. She doesn't have any of that. And if you read these articles, she says, well, there's this one virus that if it mutates in such a way, then it can cause symptoms that seem like they're related to this disease. And when we look at the COVID vaccines, there's a striking resemblance between the genetic material of this virus and the vaccine. And so ergo, right, don't get a vaccine for COVID-19. It's that kind of stuff. It's nuts. There's no reputable journal would publish that. So I could understand why someone like you who gets kicked off of science communication panels for being a white man would look at this woman and go, how is she allowed to continue? And that's where the first struggle comes for me, because I don't know what the answer is to this, Kevin. I don't want Susie Wiles to be censured or accused of anything or to have her reputation ruined. I think her university is frankly cowardly for not standing up for her. But at the same time, how do you address this? I mean, this you're in the hot seat, really. This affects you directly. So how do you fix this? Is it even possible?
Well, there's only one way out. And really, it has affected my career. And I talked to my direct boss about this yesterday. I said, my passion is in research and training students. And my passion is about doing cutting edge research and obtaining funding to do that. And I can't do that anymore. And so that's why I get more fired up about working on things in my private life and, raising a kid and all that stuff. It's really sad because I was a warrior for the truth and for science communication. I still do, but I don't get the opportunities I used to because I've been effectively taken out of those rather than having a university stand up and say, we are going to fight for you and we are going to do what we need to do to stand up for science. The same thing with Susie Wiles. It became a, you know what, let's just be quiet. And the same thing happened at Cornell and the same thing happened at UC Davis back in 2014 when all the FOIAs were coming through and all that USRTK stuff was coming through. They told their faculty, shut up, get your head down. And back then, my boss told me, you get in there and fix it. Yeah. That got really old really fast when, you know, you get millions of dollars of legal fees because of the endless FOIA requests. And so This is, and then people complaining about you and making up false information online, that it doesn't matter if it's true or not, it affects the university. And because people are saying, why are you having this puppy kicker work in your university? Or, you know, I mean, or, you know, whatever. And so that stuff has a real effect, unfortunately, because we need to be tougher in standing up for the people who are telling the truth and are willing to stick their necks out to do it. Because when you see people who are sharing science like Susie Wiles, who are doing the best work you can possibly do with beautiful work on YouTube and excellent work, when you see that going down, that means everything our organizations, our professional organizations like AAAS and NAS, that they stand for and telling us, you know, need more science communication. It means they can't, that it means that the people who are doing it are being taken out and trying to do what we're supposed to be doing. And it means everybody who's watching, all the other folks who are saying, I think I might dip a toe into talking about vaccines. They decide their careers are more important and Maybe shutting up is better. And let Dr. Seneff have the stage.
See, and that's what I don't really understand, you know? So I guess what you're saying is universities need to grow a pair and start standing up for their faculty because they're doing a valuable public service. That's what I heard you say. I think that's what you're saying. Correct me if I'm wrong. But what's weird to me is that there are universities all over the world who will protect the fringiest, goofiest academics. And they'll really go to fight for them. Like people in, and again, I've criticized the critical social justice movement and people in the social sciences that say the dumbest things, right? These people keep their jobs. They have tenure. They are defended publicly. They don't experience any pressure for the strange things they say. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm just a bit frustrated. And I don't think there's an answer. It just seems that depending on the university you're at, you may or may not get someone who's in your corner. And if you land at a school where all they want to do is not be yelled at in the media, they're gonna tuck their tail between their legs, you know? So I don't know, man. I just, I guess all I can do is try to sympathize and say this is kind of stupid, but I don't know.
It costs money to run a university. And when donors are talking about, we're going to pull our money because we don't believe in genetic engineering, or we don't believe in vaccination, or we don't believe in the science you're promoting, universities are folding to that. And that's the wrong way to go. Academic freedom is academic freedom. And if you're out there telling the truth, that's consistent with the scientific literature, you should be allowed to defend your position. If you're out there misinforming and hurting people with misinformation, that's not academic freedom. And that's the problem. It's one thing to shut up the truth tellers. It's one thing to promote the liars. Here we have this complete weirdness in academic freedom. Not only are the folks who are telling the truth being told to be quiet, the folks who are making up nonsense and causing problems, we're getting a national stage. They are being encouraged to do it. And, you know, it's a sad state of affairs. That's all I can say. And then all I would say is when you see her say something crazy on social media, please, please, please share it, retweet it, tag MIT. The only way to change this ship is to remind them that they are being complicit in the misinformation that misinformation is being spread under their banner, that their authority and their credibility is being used to hurt people. And that's where we need to be with this.
Yeah. You know, one thing that occurs to me just as we wrap up here on this story is that the anti-groups, and the Robert F. Kennedys and the crazy Joe Mercolas, who we're going to discuss in a minute, these folks have very loyal followings and they're all networked together. They all work together on a whole host of issues, vaccines, crop biotechnology, pharmaceuticals. They're all sort of pushing the same talking points and they have each other's backs. And they're coordinated in a way that academic scientists really aren't yet. It's getting better. But that's one thing if I was running MIT, this is something that would be on my mind, is that if I go in and I cut this lady down at the knees and I say, work on your AI stuff and shut up about vaccines because you're way out of your depth. You're out of your element, Donnie, right? If I was to go to her and say that, all of these folks are going to show up at my office and there's going to be pickets. And there's going to be news coverage and, how dare you, treat a woman this way? Don't you know that she's stunning and brave? And right. So I could see them sort of doing the same thing that a lot of universities have done by not defending their faculty, is that we're going to stay out of this so these people don't bark at us, So anyways, yeah, I'm glad I don't work in academia, I guess is what I'm saying, Kevin.
Yeah, I'm was going to say, I'm glad I don't either. But that's the sad part, is that the things I do best, I don't do anymore. And it breaks my heart because that's where my passions are. I do a nice job teaching students and, we do some fun stuff in the lab still. And I got some projects I really like. But, the things that I love doing, that I really made a career out of, are things I can't get to anymore. And right. I'm talking to you as outside work. I mean, this is what I do in my spare time. And now all the things that I do best are spare time things I do at home rather than things that I should be doing to enhance the university, the student experience, and things for people in my state. And, I'll stop there. It's going to end up getting me in hot water. But, let's switch it to Susie Wiles. She is a brilliant scientist who's doing great work. And when people see scientists like her or maybe me go under the bus, it changes their opinion about how much they want to engage in science communication, period.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Kevin can't say certain things, I suppose, or he's trying to be judicious, but I'll say it. Most universities are run by cowards. And whatever's the politically dominant narrative or whatever's going to keep you out of hot water, that's what prevails. And that's what really bothers me about this, is that on the free speech side, you have that issue because people will get, I don't like to say canceled, but people will be silenced if they say something that is unpopular politically. Or, as Kevin said, if it's, some donor to your school or there's somebody who can pull strings who's unhappy with something, evidence be damned. That that person's going to get their way, and that's stupid. We shouldn't live in that world, especially now, because the tagline that you see all the time is like, "Well, there's misinformation. Got it? Don't fall for misinformation." So it's like we have this narrative all over the place. Everybody's supposed to be looking out, to not be duped by disinformation and misinformation or whatever. But then you have major institutions just groveling, like, "Please don't take our funding. We love you." Like, it's like that's gross. Anyways, I'm sorry. Okay, oxalate.
Well, but this is a really great article from a great institution. So Jonathan Jerry, who is from the McGill University Office of Science and Society, the place that Joe Schwartz built. Dr. Schwartz has been on the radio every weekend in Quebec for 49 years or something. It's awesome.
Wow.
39 years. This article is called "Dietary Boogeyman is Oxalate, the New Root of Dozens Diseases." And so we can talk about these dietary boogeymen. And every once in a while, you hear of monosodium glutamate, right? And Jonathan points this out. Monosodium glutamate, you hear about lectins, you know, the wheat belly, right? And then what was some other ones? I don't know. Gluten, you know, these are all things that are these dangerous molecules that allegedly cause all your problems. Well, wheat in general, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Lectins and gluten. But this idea that there is this problematic single cause to all your problems. And then, of course, they usually have a solution to fix it. And maybe it's buying a book or buying a product. And so that's what
just 1995.
That's right. Yeah. I was thinking the year. Like, what happened in 95? Right.
Yeah, it's a subscription service now.
Yeah, so so the big deal is that there's a new book, and it falls directly into this trap around oxalate. And this is the new boogeyman, and it comes from a book by Sally K. Norton, who says the book is called Toxic Superfoods, How Oxalate Overload is Making You Sick and How to Get Better. And this is a rising star in Amazon books, somewhere up at the top of health and wellness or whatever. And what is oxalate? So oxalate is a biologically produced molecule. It's present in the human body, very simple molecule. It's a product of metabolism. It is part of the Krebs cycle. It's, you know this stuff from many different contexts. But it turns out that a lot of fruits and vegetables are very high in oxalate. So things like spinach, potatoes a little bit, rhubarb. The big ones are things like kiwi fruits, star fruit, carambola. I love the things high in oxalate. Figs, high in oxalate. So lots of fruits and vegetables are high in oxalate. Why does it matter? Well, kidney stones are high in oxalic acid or oxalate. So when you get a kidney stone, you find, okay, you break this thing up and it's all oxalate, which is coming from human metabolism and from the fruit we eat, the things we eat. So she seems to believe that a low oxalate diet is a good thing, and that's part of the way you avoid these problems, such as kidney stones and vulva pain, which we'll get to. And the American Association of Urologists doesn't agree. They don't recommend a low oxalate diet. They say maybe think about foods that you eat that are high in oxalate. And maybe limit those or whatever, but they don't say a low oxalate diet is a good thing. So it's one of these things that you, the experts aren't prescribing the same thing as this book discusses. And we're not talking about peer-reviewed literature. We're talking about a book. And so that's really the stepping off point of this article is you have a book that's out that's very popular saying oxalate is a culprit and experts saying, maybe not.
So a couple of things that stood out about this article. The one is just his approach to the subject is great because he introduces it. He says, here's what they say. Here's what their literature is. Now, here's what the science says. And he goes in and he says, well, here's what the society statements are. You know, these are these expert bodies. Here's the peer-reviewed literature. Here's the only thing I could find about, you know, in support of this, which was a case report that the author of this book co-authored, I believe. And the only studies that have been done, I believe, were studies where the women involved paid to be involved in the studies, and they also had to buy supplements from the researcher, right? So this has all of the hallmarks of a scam, right? This is, I think it's worse than a pyramid scheme because there's not even the promise that you're going to get anything. It's just like, you know, but give me money and I'll study you. It's, you know, I can't imagine any like IRB would call that ethical, right? This has to be done outside of mainstream science, I would imagine. So that's interesting. I thought that was the first thing is that he goes through this. It's sort of a course in how you identify garbage science. But the other thing that stuck out is that all of these sort of, whether they're talking about like a miracle food, like acai berry or whatever, or, you know, honey, like whatever it is, whatever miracle food, it always starts with, well, my cousin Sally was in the forest one day and she discovered acai berries and she ate some and, you know, this arthritis she had for 40 years just disappeared right on the spot. Isn't that crazy? And you're like, I guess, you know, I don't really know what, like anything about that, but after that initial anecdote, it's never built upon. There's never like, okay, well, let's look at the epidemiology. Okay, let's put together a clinical trial and let's see if we can really isolate what's going on here. That never happens. That happens with real medicine, right? Like you discover, like we were talking about a few weeks ago, you discover some venom that animals use to kill each other. And we go, oh, well, we can synthesize that, or we can make something into a useful drug out of that. And then all the science comes from that. But with this stuff, it goes from like, oh, anecdote from Cousin Sally, best-selling Amazon book. And that's all that ever happens, you know? So that's what stuck out to me. What are your thoughts on either of those?
Well, so much of this is this weird anecdotal science, but also like really poorly conducted research. That's a person they describe as, I can't remember his first name now, but the last name was Solomons. And yeah. His whole thing was, he was a biochemist by training, PhD biochemist, not a medical doctor, who was testing herbs that or plants that he found on the side of a mountain as cures for issues with or causes for oxalate associated problems. And the focus was really around a woman named Sherry, who he says in 1982 developed a stinging pain in her crotch that said it was described as someone putting out a cigarette in her genitals. And I was, and the first thing I ask is, what kind of friends does she have? And who are these, you know, who are the smokers in her life who gave her this analogy?
Not my kind of party, that's for sure.
You know, this is exactly what it's like. But the whole thing was based upon this guy Solomon's doing research that was looking at the role of oxalates in different issues. And the book, which comes out from Sally Norton, it says some of the things, and I have to look at the list here, of things that are caused by increased oxalate. Here we go. Digestive distress, inflamed joints, chronic skin issues, brain fog, mood problems, stiff neck, carpal tunnel syndrome, pain that never resolves, eye floaters, reflux, shortness of breath, yeast infections, clumsiness, headaches, anxiety, panic disorder. And the first thing I think is, I must be getting a lot of oxalate. I got all of it. Right. I do like the star fruits. We grow those. But the bottom line is that she picks all of these rather amorphous disorders,
right,
that they would also have blamed on aspartame and blamed on GMOs and blamed on glyphosate and blamed on whatever, whatever the toxin du jour is, because these are the aches and pains that people experience with freaking life.
Right.
And so the, you know,
clumsiness, really.
Yeah, clumsiness. You know, I mean, you know, eye floaters. You know, digestive distress. You know, after you just ate 10 tacos, there's so many. It's so by keeping it in the, like, who amongst us has ever said, I haven't had shortness of breath in the last 2 weeks, or a stiff neck, you know, or inflamed joints. I mean, it happens to everybody who's playing hard. And so it turns out that she has a lot of interesting things that people would point out as conflicts of interest if they were me. She was managing projects for the National Center of Complementary and Integrative Health, which used to be the National Center of Complementary and Alternative Medicine at NIH. So she was actively involved in funded projects in complementary and alternative medicine, which this program at NIH turns out the least productive research, I mean, of any of them, and has been really called for to be ended by most folks. But she also is anti-GMO big time, and also suggests that lab-grown meat is cancer tissue to be sold as human food. So she's out there on a limb, lauded by many, and getting rich by selling a book by a new food boogeyman. So there you go.
Yeah, so much to mention even just there. But as I said, right, birds of a feather, you know. So, yeah, you need a low oxalate diet. Also, GMOs are bad for you. You know, it's just, I don't know, it's just a mindset that has to reject anything that's mainstream science or medicine. You have to discard these, right? It's a part of a really strange worldview that I find so irritating, because there's well-meaning people out there. I have people in my family I've mentioned before who they read something on some alternative news site, or they see it on Newsmax, or they see it on, you know, whatever, you know, pick your favorite random website, and they go, oh, well, you know, kidney stones are bad. I don't want those. I guess I'm just going to never eat a potato again. You just like, I don't know, man. It's weird stuff like this. I don't get it. I would like to get inside the heads of people who promote this, but then people who embrace it, that it resonates with them. You know, there's all these theories we've talked about why it happens, but it's just really frustrating that this, you know, like, oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't like GMOs and I don't like vaccines. And, you know, I don't like antidepressants, and, I guess oxalate's bad too. Like it's just one other thing that you don't, I don't know, man.
Well, you maybe give it too much credit. I think that it's following the format of, if you can find the poison du jour, was everybody tries to understand why they have problems, right? Everyone's trying to find out why they have health issues or something wrong or whatever. You clamor for some sort of solution that is an easy solution, that isn't diet and exercise and you know, poor lifestyle or whatever. So let's find something to blame it on, like oxalate, like glutamate or monosodium glutamate, like glyphosate, whatever. And really what it really boils down to is, don't buy books to try to understand what's wrong. Talk to your physician, pay attention to the peer-reviewed literature. Let's get it right. I'll stop there. I've been complaining too much, so I'm getting cranky.
Nah, it's okay. I'll just say that I actually take a potato and I put oxalate on the potato, then I put glyphosate on the potato, and then I put MSG on it, and then I blend it, and then it's the best. It's a superfood.
Everything ends in ATE, by the way. Don't eat anything that ends in ATE.
Yeah.
Glyphosate, yeah. Oxalate, glutamate, what's
Colgate,
glutenate. Yeah, no, it's chemophobia again, and right. Just the way things roll, you know. Hey, my background looks nice now towards the end here.
It's getting a little colorful. I dig it, man. I mentioned before we started recording, it looks like an Ansel Adams photograph. So, you know, there you go.
It's some weird glitch with my camera. So they got a warm light in the front, and I got the backdrop is just the sun setting in lovely Archer, Florida. So.
It's much better. I mean, I have my bookshelf, so you all think I'm smart, but I don't have I don't own a farm, so I don't have anything. Kevin always outshines me on that kind of stuff. So anyways, so we're not doing the Twitter thing. Do you have anything you want to leave people with before we call it a day?
No, don't be really careful when you're listening to so-called experts. And I think that's a really important theme of today, whether it's Senef or, this other one, I don't even remember her name now, Norton. There are people out there who are trying to sell you a bill of goods. And folks like Zarek are a lot more credible. And even they have to be looked at critically. And he would agree with the same thing. As you should always question what Cameron and I say too. So be a critical thinker. And that's where we need to leave it.
There you go. Good stuff. Well, we'll call it a day. You can follow us on Twitter at Kevin Folta. At ACSH.org is where you'll find my writing and my website, CameronJEnglish.net. Of course, follow Genetic Literacy Project. They are at Genetic Literacy. They put this whole show on. They're letting us do video now, which is cool, so you can see our faces. And with that, we're done with 202. We'll be back next week for 203. Thank you so much.